Coming up on the Kevin O'Connor Show, we're doing my power rankings from 30 to 1, and then Tom Haverstraw comes on to discuss some of those takeaways and what we've seen this week in the NBA. You ready for some power rankings? These are my championship tier power rankings. I'm thinking about only finals odds here, the team that's going to be hoisting the trophy at the end. And we're going to start with number 30 and go all the way to number one. So let's start with the first tier, the poop for Cooper flag tier. These are the tanking teams hoping to get lottery luck in May. But Cooper flag isn't the only prize. This year's draft is becoming increasingly deep as the college season progresses. So it's not just Cooper as a prize. Number 30, the Washington Wizards. Chris Middleton, they get him at the deadline. He's out. Marcus Smart, get him at the deadline. He's out. This team is tanking their asses off. And here's the thing, though. I'm not sure what to make of their future guys. Bilal Coulibaly, Alex Sarr. Bilal this year, 27% on catch and shoot threes, worse than last year. Only 18th percentile in pick and roll scoring, according to Synergy Sports. Putting the ball in his hands has not resulted in a huge uptick in scoring from him. I'm worried there. Sarr, no surprise he's not scoring off the dribble. 2 of 14 on isolation shots this season. The issue is this. This is a bad stat. 28% on rolls to the rim. That means when Sarr sets a screen and he rolls to the basket and receives the ball, he's shooting only 28%. Not a great lob threat, hasn't shown the ability to overpower defenders off the dribble, has not looked like a guy that can create for himself even in that situation, and then he's only 32% on catch and shoot threes. I might be out of the French prospect business. I might be out. Wemby's the only one who's treated any of us right. I whiffed on Killian Hayes bigger than anybody did. This year, Nolan Traore, a top French point guard prospect supposed to be a top five pick, has really struggled. So if you're the Wizards and you don't end up with Cooper, I'm thinking about a guy like Con Knipple. 38% from three, 88% from the line. He's a playmaker, hard-nosed defender. Just a nice American with a funny name. So for all of these teams in the tanking category, I'm going to pair them with a non-Cooper prospect just to show that there's more prizes out there this year. And for the Wizards, ooh, man, I'm not taking another Frenchie, dude, because I'm worried about Bilal's offense and Sarr overall. Number 29, the Utah Jazz. Isaiah Collier, dude. Isaiah Collier feels like a real thing. Last 20 games, 8.7 assists per game to 3.4 turnovers. Last six games, if you zoom in, 10.3 assists per game to 2.8 turnovers. Now, Collier in high school and college, this is like a downhill bully ball point guard attacker. In college, my notes for him in my draft guide: daredevil playmaker who needs to cut down on reckless mistakes without removing the spirit that makes him so dynamic. That's one of them. Another one: with the way he throws the ball into traffic, sometimes it's as if he assumes defenders can't see. And then the third one: he needs to play a more composed, controlled style. That's what he's doing. He went up from 4.3 assists to 3.3 turnovers last year at USC to this guy with an amazing assist to turnover ratio. He looks for real. You pair him with Keontae George, they have like a yin and yang thing going there with George's fluid perimeter-based style. And then you got Collier, this downhill guy who's now figuring out how to play make. I'd like to see the Jazz take Ace Bailey, 6'10 shot maker out of Rutgers. Great three-point shooter, looks like MPJ. Add him to spice things up if it's not Cooper. 28, Charlotte, Brandon Miller out for the season. Mark Williams, who really knows? LaMelo Ball in and out of the lineup. I don't trust that LaMelo's going to be the guy long-term there. I love LaMelo. I love what he is. I think he's a fantastic player, but he's always hurt. The inefficiency is definitely a concern with him. So for the Hornets, even if LaMelo is your guy, it doesn't hurt to have another playmaker out there. So Dylan Harper, also from Rutgers, 6'6", big guard, can play with LaMelo or maybe be the man for them next to Brandon Miller if they decided to pivot off of LaMelo. Number 27, the New Orleans Hornets. I got to say, man, who are their actual keepers? I think they got one of them, only one. Herb Jones used to be one, but his shooting has fallen off a cliff, out for the season now. But 31% on the year from three, down from 42% last year, 37% career guy. Jones is still an elite defender. He's got a high IQ. He can pass the ball as well. But the shooting, needs to be real for him. And I'm worried that Fred Vinson, the shooting coach who helped him improve, is now gone. He's in Detroit now. I wonder if that's a correlation there with Herb's shooting dip this year. So I'm concerned there. And then Zion, borderline keeper, because I don't think you're going to get value if you trade him. One reason why you might lean towards keeper is because he's trending up. First two seasons of his career, Zion shot 72% on self-created chances in the restricted area. That's just pure dominance. That's Shaq. That's Giannis. That's elite. Then he was down to 62% last season. And then to start this season, he was down to 52%. And then over the past month, this is when he's been playing more consistently, he's back up to 71%. That's encouraging for Zion. I lean towards keep unless somebody overwhelms you. The only true keeper, though, on the Pelicans is Trey Murphy. Last 15 games, 25.4 points per game, 41.4% from three on 8.2 attempts, 4.5 assists to only 1.9 turnovers, plus 5.7 boards, plus good defense, almost two steals per game. Trey Murphy, he's emerging. He looks like a Chris Middleton, but bigger out there right now. If you are keeping him long-term, which you better be, if you're keeping Zion, those are two of your front court guys. I'd want to go for like a Malawach from Duke, a big raw five who's got some touch. Maybe he can shoot threes, play with Zion, can play with Murphy. Again, it's not just about Cooper this year. There's a lot of potential prizes. Number 26, the Brooklyn Nets. They're frisky, man. They're frisky. They've won three in a row. They've won 6 of 7. They don't need to tank because I would expect they're going to consolidate their picks. They have number 7, 20, 24, 27, and 36. I can't imagine they keep all of those. That'd be kind of crazy if they do that. If they do end up with a top 5-ish or so pick, VJ Edgecombe, he is ascending big time to close this season. 6'4", 6'5", great shooter, can attack, a little bit of a creator, more of a secondary guy, emerging, you know, versatile defender as well, can fit what this Nets team is doing on the defensive end as of late. But how many of these Nets guys are really going to be with the team for the next 3-4 years? I hope Jordy Fernandez ends up tanking because, oh, as nice it would be to compete for a play-in spot and close the year strong, these guys aren't long-term pieces. Number 25, the Chicago Bulls. So John Hollinger over at The Athletic said earlier in the week that the Bulls had a first-round pick on the table for Lonzo Ball. That's true. I mentioned that they had some strong offers prior to the deadline for Lonzo. What I've heard is that the offer wasn't straight up like a first. It was Lonzo in a second for a first. So they would have moved up into the first round. You could argue that's something that they should do in this situation, but and they'd be getting a player back as well who they could trade again this summer or next season. I think the Bulls should have done something like that. Even just moving up into the first in this year's class, again, a lot of good depth. Why would they not do that for a guy who missed the last two seasons and has major knee issues and it hasn't even been awesome this year? Lonzo's just fun. He sets a tone, but to me, that's a deal the Bulls should have made, but nothing they do really makes any sense at all. Something that would make sense. Jeremiah Fears from Oklahoma, smaller point guard, could fit really well with Bouzelis and Giddey with what they're building there. Number 24, this is the last team in our poop for Cooper tier, the Toronto Raptors. The Raptors trade for Brandon Ingram, give him a 3-year, $120 million extension. I don't really know what to expect from this. Ingram is not going to play for Toronto until after the deadline. It's a weird fit with Scottie Barnes and everything else they have there, but I've always liked Ingram. I had him ranked number one in his draft class. They're a weird team. Give him a weird player. Derek Queen, Maryland big man. He looks like Zach Randolph. He'd be a nice addition for them. So this is the poop for Cooper tier here. Six teams, big group. Some of these teams could move out of it by the end of the year, but let's move on to the next tier, the League Pass Darlings. These are the teams that are fun to watch, but they're not going anywhere. They have a 0% chance at the NBA Finals, but they're fun to watch. So don't get mad at me if your team is here and there are some surprises in this group. The first two are not a big surprise if you listen to my podcast. Portland, number 23, nobody should be surprised here. They moved out of the poop for Cooper category for now. DeAndre Ayton out for the season, it seems like. This is a big opportunity for Donovan Clingan. His first game getting 30-plus minutes since November. Ayton out, Time Lord out. Clingan had 17 points, 20 boards, 3 blocks. If you look at the Rookie of the Year odds right now, as of recording, maybe this changes. Clingan is plus 10,000 across different odds makers. He's not even listed on some books. Plus 10,000? $5 to win $500. When there's no clear-cut favorite, Castle still coming off the bench for the Spurs, other guys in and out of the lineup. Klingon, if he plays every game the rest of the season and closes with more like 2020 type of games, again, $5 to win $500, that's not a bad gamble. Blazers are fun. They're going to have a lot of eyeballs on them as well. Number 22, the Atlanta Hawks. They've been better since the deadline than I anticipated that they would be. They went to overtime in a thriller against the Knicks. Good on them for some of those competitive games and had a good win against the Magic. Thinking about young guys, Reese Hoshea looks like a bust. I'm increasingly worried about Reese Hoshea. He looks like the biggest bust since Fultz in 2017, maybe even Bennett in 2013. Because of the three-pointer, this was my concern pre-draft. This is why I had him outside of my top 10. 32% from three on the year, only 71% from the free throw line. Those numbers perfectly align with everything he's done throughout his entire professional career, besides the first half of last season, when he was 48% from three over the first 30 or so games. And then he fell back to his norms. And this year, it's the same thing with Atlanta, where you see the flashes of a 30-point game, a hot shooting night, and you're like, oh my God. But those are rare, and I have concerns there, man. 30% on pull-up twos, 46% on layups. He's not a self-creator. We know that already about him. He's more of a high-end role player you hope for him to be. As a number one pick, I don't know, man. I'm a bit concerned there for Atlanta. I am. Despite how good everything else has looked this year with Trey, playmaker, Jalen Johnson. Like, there's a lot of good things happening in Atlanta, but the Reese Hoshea pick I am worried about. Moving on to some of the hard ones within this category of these league pass darlings. This one, people are going to get mad at me. Number 21, the Detroit Pistons. I know they're the sixth seed. I know they're 29 and 26 on the year entering the break. I know Cade Cunningham looks awesome, and Ausar Thompson does, and a lot of their young guys do. Even Jalen Duren's been better in recent stretches. But this isn't a finals team. It's not. And that's why they're in this spot here. They're not a finals team. There's 0% chance they win the finals. They're not there yet. But they're ascending. Good for them. They've moved out of the poop for Cooper type of categories. They're not tanking anymore. Same thing for this next team. Granted, their situation's a little bit different. The Indiana Pacers, number 20 on my power rankings here. Haliburton looks awesome ever since the NBA Cup in the early mid-December. He looks like himself. Their defense has been way better as well since that stretch. 12th in defensive rating, 7th in offensive rating. They're competitive. They're a good regular season team. They're fun to watch. All of these things are true. They're not a finals team. Same thing with this next one, which is probably going to be the team that people get mad at me the most for. The Orlando Magic, number 19 on my power rankings. I just don't see it, man. Franz Wagner, the real deal. This guy is legit. He's a two-way blossoming star, versatile defender. He can drop 30 on you even without having a hot shooting night because of his ability to get downhill, the pull-up ability, the playmaking ability. The dude's legit. Banchero, I don't know. I don't know. I had Banchero number one on my board in his draft ahead of Jabari Smith and Chet Holmgren. I don't know. I don't know about Banchero. I don't know about him defensively. I don't know about him as a decision maker, playmaker, shooter. There's a lot of question marks there. I don't know. And you factor in like that Franz and Paolo, neither of them are great shooters. The rest of this roster isn't either. So sorry, Orlando. You're not a threat. Not yet. Next up in our league pass darlings tier, Sacramento, 18. I'm kind of shocked Fultz went unsigned for this long. He's a good defender, good playmaker. I think he can provide some nice depth to this Kings team. Valanciunas and Sabonis, I hope in the second half of the year after the break, we see them play more together. I want to see some of those two big lineups. They've played only 7 minutes together since Valanciunas was acquired. Kings outscored their opponents 21-14 over that stretch. I'd like to see more than 7 minutes. I'm not sure how well it would work, but I'd like to see what does Sabonis look like playing the four next to a five. Next up, the Miami Heat at number 17. Got blown out by Brooklyn, blown out by Boston, blown out by OKC since the deadline. We're recording this before the Dallas game on Thursday night. Their offense looks absolutely horrific, stuck in the mud. And part of that is because of this Tyler Hero collapse ever since he was named an all-star. 24% from three, 5 turnovers per game almost. Dealing with a groin issue, so I'm not overly concerned, but I mean, it's gross. This offense was gross before Hero was named an all-star. It feels even grosser now. They get a lot of work to do, man. And they're not a finals threat. They are not a finals threat, even in the slightest. Even 17 might be too high on these rankings. You look at this group, these are good, fun teams to watch. Some of them are, but none of them are finals teams. Let's move on to the next year. Gripping the electrical cord. These are the teams. Maybe you pull the plug. Maybe it's better to miss the playoffs. Number 16, who else could it be but the Philadelphia 76ers? Joel Embiid, in and out of the lineup all the time. Paul George, man. You see that game he had against the Nets the other night? 1 of 7 for 2 points. This is a game in which Oubre had 30 and Quentin Grimes had 30, and Paul George looked like the worst wing on the team, like he has a lot this season. I don't know if Paul George is playing down to the situation or if he's just fallen off a cliff. I don't know. But either way, it really, really hurts what you can imagine the Sixers team to be. The issue for them is their pick is only top six protected. Otherwise, it goes to Oklahoma City. So right now, they have the sixth best lottery odds. The sixth slot gives you a 37.23%. I'm giving the double decimal percentage there. 37.23% chance of keeping that pick. That's not that great. A little over a third. And then you have the teams ahead of them. The Wizards, the Pelicans, the Jazz, the Hornets, the Raptors. Maybe you move ahead of the Raptors, and even then your odds only go up to 42.1% to keep that pick. I think the Sixers got to go for it. I do. Normally, I'd be all about the tank here. Try to go get Cooper. Rest Embiid. Punt for next season. Normally, I'd be about that. But Embiid, another year older. George, another year older. Who are these free agent veterans going to come? Like, who's going to come back? You don't know. A lot of them are hitting the market here. They have the fourth easiest schedule remaining in the NBA this season. I think the Sixers just got to go for it, try to get into the play-in, and, you know, who freaking knows? Who knows what happens? Number 15 of our gripping the electrical cord tier in these power rankings, the Dallas Mavericks. I hate to say it. I don't actually believe they'll tank. I don't believe they will pull the cord, but who would have thought they'd do that when they had Luka and Kyrie a couple of years back? They ended up with Derek Lively. That really worked out. Lively became a pivotal part of their team last season on their run all the way to the finals. And now they're in a situation, AD out, avoiding surgery so far for now. Lively out until April sometime. Gafford out for a couple of weeks. PJ Washington currently out. How many times can you expect Kyrie Irving to turn into Stephen Curry and drop 40-plus points and hit everything on the floor and be perfect as a playmaker as well? How many times can you expect that? Because that's going to happen again and again and again with teams sending two at Kyrie after he starts going off like the Warriors did the other night. The Mavericks won that game against Golden State. But I think there's a chance. I think there's a chance the Mavs pull the plug here. He is, as tough as that would be to do after... You know, Dallas fans, you know. How tough would that? I just can't imagine doing that after trading Luka for AD. I can't imagine it. The context is so much different than it was a couple years ago when they decided to tank out of the playoffs. But maybe they should. They should at least think about it. So that's our group here. Dallas and Philadelphia for gripping the electrical cord. I don't see either of them winning the finals. 0% chance. And that's also true for this next group as well. The something's missing. Teams here. These are the teams where, like, you know, maybe they make a run, maybe they win a round or two, but they're not going to make the finals. They're definitely not going to win the finals. That starts us off with 14, the San Antonio Spurs. You got De'Aaron Fox. Him and Victor Wembanyama can win you a series. Stephon Castle is having some really big games, but the Spurs don't have enough wings. They don't have a backup five, and their lineups make no freaking sense at all. Why is Chris Paul still starting? I've yet to hear a good reason besides, oh, he's the veteran. They probably promised him to start. Who cares? It doesn't matter. Now you have De'Aaron Fox and you have Stephon Castle, who's significantly outplaying him. So why is Paul still starting? And even if he is starting, why is he playing more minutes next to Fox and Wemby than Castle is? So he's played 77 minutes with Fox and Wemby to only 28 minutes for Castle with Fox and Wemby. How is that? It doesn't make any sense to me. It doesn't help in the short term because Castle's better than Paul right now. And it doesn't help in the long term because you're trying to get your core pieces to get time together. I just don't get it. It's stupid. It's short-sighted. And it honestly pisses me off. It pisses me off watching the Spurs. It just makes zero sense. It makes zero sense for short-term, long-term, no matter how you want to look at it. The only way it makes sense is making Chris Paul happy that he doesn't have to come off the bench, which is dumb. I'd rather cut him than deal with that. It just doesn't make any sense. Number 13, the Phoenix Suns. They're 26-28 on the season. They stink. They're the 11 seed. They're not going to win the finals. Putting him this high might be silly as well. KD, okay, we've heard one team that had interest in him ahead of the deadline. A lot of people had reported on the Timberwolves as a team that made calls. I had a conversation earlier this week on my podcast with John Krasinski, the great Timberwolves beat writer, reporter. He mentioned Minnesota's interest is genuine. The other teams I've heard, the Grizzlies, the Rockets, and the Knicks. Those are the KD teams to watch for over the summer, if KD's moved, which, as Windhorst said, I believe he will be. Grizzlies, Rockets, Knicks, Timberwolves. Timberwolves have by far the least assets of that group. Grizzlies, Rockets have the most. Knicks also don't have a lot of ways to go about it as well, but it also would depend on what the Suns would want in return for KD. They're not winning the finals. Number 12, the Houston Rockets. This might come as a surprise. They're a top seed in the West. Amen Thompson ascending. I'm a big believer. I love Amen. I think he's one of the best players in basketball in the year 2025. Jalen Green, I'm a believer despite his inconsistencies. They have a lot of good role players. Şengün, I have question marks, even though he's an all-star. I just can't get there. I can't get there no matter how much I love the foundation here. They remind me of OKC last year, where they're really 1 year away from actual contention. Putting them number 12 feels pretty fair to me. They're not a finals team. They're not a contender, but they're close. Number 11, the Minnesota Timberwolves. They are also in this something's missing group. I just don't see it. I don't see it with them. They've been better as of late, but then they have a loss to the Cavs. They lose to the Bucks without Giannis, and you get Kevin Porter Jr. playing insane defense down the stretch against Anthony Edwards and the Wolves. And then they face OKC as well. You're going to hear this after they face OKC. Maybe that goes well for them. I can't imagine it does. But I think Minnesota, they went after KD because they know. They know what they have isn't enough. And I think the only way this year, and I've hammered this point over and over and over already this season. So if you've been listening to my podcast, you're like, Rob Dillingham, give him minutes. Yes, you're right. Rob Dillingham, give him minutes. And Terrence Shannon, too, for that matter. You're two rookies. Shannon's 24 years old. He played 8 years in college. Roll him out there and see what you can get from this guy who's a downhill attacker, 20-plus point-per-game guy in the college level. And Dillingham, he's a bucket-getter, whether he's playing for Donda Academy or Kentucky, and he's done it with Minnesota this year. Dillingham and Shannon are the guys they need to invest in because Nah, Ingles, Conley, those guys are not ceiling raisers. It's short-sighted to have those guys playing heavy minutes and not Dillingham, not Shannon, because maybe as rookies, they end up having like a Christian Brown type of impact in the playoffs. Maybe they help Anthony Edwards get to the finals and maybe win it. But these veterans, especially Conley and Ingles, they're okay. They're not going to raise the ceiling. Dillingham and Shannon maybe can lower the floor, but they can also raise your ceiling. They got to roll the dice. Minnesota's got to do that. I don't think they're a finals team unless they do that. That's why I have them in this tier with these other squads that I don't believe have a chance to win the finals. Next up, got three teams in the respect your elders tier. I don't think any of these teams are winning the finals either, but there's a chance they move up into the contenders category. Number 10, the Clippers. They get everything you need. Besides your superstar, Harden's an all-star. Norman Powell could have been an all-star. Zubats could have been an all-star. He's been tremendous this year for them. They get defenders, Jones, Coffey, Dunn, Batum, Kawhi Leonard. That's the only question mark. Is Kawhi Leonard going to turn back into the Kawhi Leonard we've seen just dominate? Or is he going to be, he's good. He's solid. That's the only question with the Clippers. If they get that real Kawhi Leonard come April, they move up. They might even move up into the top five because they have everything else. The Clippers have everything else. They just need Kawhi Leonard to become Kawhi Leonard again. Number 9, the Golden State Warriors. Steph talked about how this is the last ride for them with Draymond Green recording this ahead of the Houston game on Thursday. They're coming off a really bad loss against Dallas. Gonna get Buddy Hield out of the starting five, man. He's horrible. can't shoot anymore after his hot stretch to start the year, not an impactful defender or passer. I don't know what the hell he's doing out there starting games or playing heavy minutes for Steve Kerr anymore. More pods, more Moody, more Gary Payton II for that matter. What is Kerr waiting for here? Butler's looked good next to Steph and Draymond so far. Draymond's defense down the stretch in that Mavericks game, Legler said it on the broadcast, and he's right. If you wanted to put tape together for Draymond to be Defensive Player of the Year, it'd be the end of that game with his rotations, his decisions, the shot, the paint protection as well. Draymond was outstanding, and Steph has looked rejuvenated ever since Butler got there. So Warriors, they move up. I still don't think they're a finals team, but they're in the respect your elders category because, hey, you never know. Number eight, the Milwaukee Bucks. It was very tempting to put them in a something missing category, but then I remember they have Giannis Antetokounmpo and Damian Lillard. So that's why the next category of the real contenders is tempting too. But I feel like this is a middle ground. You respect the Bucks. They've been there before. They've won a finals with Giannis and Brook Lopez and some of these guys still on the team. And then you have guys like Dame who have made playoff runs. So I can't quit the Bucks, but I don't think they belong in this next category until we really see some sustained high-level success. So the Bucks, the Warriors, and the Clippers, that trio belongs in the respect your elders category, but not the next category, which is our contender-ish group. These are the guys that I think they can win the finals. They got a chance. These next seven teams all have a shot. Contender-ish. Number seven, the Memphis Grizzlies. I want to talk about Ja Morant because, I mean, Ja is obviously the key to everything. This team, they have depth, they have versatility, yada, yada, yada. Talked about them a ton on the podcast this year. But Ja Morant, not putting up the same numbers that he normally does, down to around 20 points per game. Efficiency is not the same level as his peak either. Here's the thing, though. This year, the Grizzlies have a 117.3 offensive rating with Ja. It's 116.8 without Ja. That is not abnormal from past years. The Grizzlies have historically been good without Ja Morant on the floor. This year is a little different in the sense that they've installed a completely brand new offensive system. They've been low in pick and rolls and handoffs, by far outliers compared to everybody else in the NBA, using off-ball movement, cutting to occupy space. Thinking Basketball did an outstanding video about that back in, I think, December, really breaking that down. But Ja's role in that offense has been strange. Over his career until this season, he averaged 34 pick and rolls run per game. That was at 17 entering the month of February. It was halved. It's back up to 24 this month. So you're seeing Ja run more pick and roll. I would expect that to continue to increase over the second half of the season because what the Grizzlies are trying to build is this multi-layered offense where they can run heavy pick and roll with Ja and Jaren Jackson or Ja and Zach Edey. They can run it down to the ground and have Ja going downhill, or they can do this weird, funky, cutting movement motion style that they've helped install so they can continue to thrive at a high level even without Ja. And I think the pick and roll is important for Ja because he scored only 30 points twice this season, shooting only 59% at the rim. That's the worst since his rookie season. Only 42% from mid-range, his worst since his rookie year. And then only 32% from three as well. Obviously, a subpar number. So Ja thrives in the pick and roll. They need to get that going by the end of the year for me to really move them up this list. For now, number seven, they're a contender-ish team. Number six, the New York Knicks. Obviously, this team is outstanding offensively. Number two, an offensive rating on the season. Brunson, Cat, those guys are absolutely incredible talents. Can they get through Boston? Can they get through Boston, though? We've seen the Celtics this year. They just look like they're overwhelming for New York. The Knicks are 0-2 against the Celtics this season. Knicks gave up the most threes in the NBA. The Celtics take the most and make nearly the most. Cat at the five works against almost every team, but maybe not Boston. And that's where Mitchell Robinson returning is going to be pivotal for them. So Knicks, contender-ish. They get a chance to win the finals, but they're not quite a favorite. The Lakers at number five. They're the only team in the NBA with two top 5 to 10 players. The only one. They have really good depth, except for the big man position. That's where small ball is the question. Is that going to be enough if you have to go against Jokic in the Western Conference Finals? If you have to go against Cleveland in the finals, who knows what the matchups will be, but can small ball be enough? very thin on the margins. Their loss against Utah on Wednesday, I thought was pretty telling there. Dorian Finney-Smith wasn't out there. No chance without him. And then Jackson Hayes gets hurt in the first half of that game, and they go to Alex Len, who's always been bad. I don't understand why they signed Alex Len. There are other bigs in the market who I think were better fits for the Lakers, basketball-wise, fit-wise, Mo Bamba being one of them. Shoots nearly 40% from three. He blocks more shots than Len, offers better rim protection than Len. Len was a zero with point guards in his career. Trae Young with De'Aaron Fox. Bamba had never had. I'm talking about Mo Bamba for the fifth-ranked team. It sounds silly, but that does make a difference. That decision, they might regret taking Alex Len for this roster, but almost maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe they're just going to end up playing a ton of small ball anyway. Or maybe the Mark Williams trade gets reversed again. We'll see. For now, the Lakers, only contender-ish. They get a shot to win the finals because they have two top 5 to 10 players in LeBron and Luka. But maybe they drop down by the end of the year as well. So that's our contender-ish teams. The Lakers, the Knicks, and the Grizzlies. I believe all three of them have a shot to win the finals, but they're not the favorites. I have four favorites. Let's start with number four, the Denver Nuggets. Third in net rating, back to dominance ever since they had their poor start to the season. Third in net rating, plus 14.1 with Jokic on the floor during this stretch, only minus 1.7 without him. So that's a 15.8 point differential, up from 20.4 differential last year, up from 22.9 the year they won the finals. And this is trending up for the Nuggets as well. They've been positive without Jokic on the floor this entire past month. That's in part because of Jamal Murray continuing to get better, looking more like his former self or even better than his former self. MPJ, Christian Brown playing at a high level. Russell Westbrook has missed some time as well, but whether it's him or the Gordon when he was coming off the bench, they have a good rotation now, a good bench unit that has been able to help support these non-Jokic lineups, and the youth is stepping up too. Jalen Pickett especially has looked great with Russell Westbrook out in recent weeks. So Denver, they feel complete to me. They feel complete. They're a legitimate finals contender. Their size with Jokic and his just godly skill on the court prevents challenges. He is a non-defendable player. You cannot stop him no matter what you do. And Jamal Murray coming along, I said it earlier in the season. I think it was our New Year's Eve pod. What's the biggest questions of 2025? One of them for me was, what level does Jamal Murray reach? Well, he has 55 points on Wednesday night. He's looking like his former self. If he's back, the Nuggets are back, and I believe they are. Number three, the Boston Celtics are the defending champions. Maybe they should be even higher for that reason. They're trending up shooting. I was concerned earlier in the year if they had tired legs, and maybe they do, but it's been better this past month. 38% from three, very comparable to their 38.8% last season. Porzingis is looking better and better and better. It wouldn't shock me if the Celtics just roll the second half of the season here. 27 games remaining. They have the third easiest schedule in the entire NBA. All their opponents have a win percentage of 46.7. I can't imagine they catch Cleveland 5.5 back. I can't imagine that, but maybe they move up to number one or two on this championship power rankings. That's a real possibility here, but I think Boston could be one of those teams that re-solidifies themselves as a major, major, major threat consensus-wise over the second half of the year here. Still, I'm keeping them behind number two, the Cleveland Cavaliers. Cleveland, 44-10 on the year, number one in offensive rating. I'm amazed by what they built and how soon they did it with Kenny Atkinson as their head coach. 39.3% on three-pointers. First in the NBA in percentage, fourth in attempts. But they're not just, this isn't to diminish what Boston did last year, but Cleveland has so many more layers with the way they can run pick and roll with Mitchell or Garland. They have bigs like Mobley who can roll or pop. Allen, an incredible roller and passer off of those rolls. They can play with motion and movement. They can go through the elbows. And then you even add a guy like DeAndre Hunter. Cavs fans saw this the other night. Had 18 points for them. Had, I think, four three-pointers in the game, all spot-ups. But opening quarter, they ran pick and roll with him, small pick and rolls with a guard setting a screen for him, and he attacked off the dribble, got into the paint, scored inside. It's just another layer when you're talking about a 6'8", 6'9", beefy forward who can create off the dribble or be a 3-and-D style role player. So I think they're matchup proof offensively. And then they're also 8th in defensive rating with versatile lineups, a ton of wings, Max Strus, Dean Wade, DeAndre Hunter now. Like, this team is legit, dude. They're not just a regular season phony. They're not. They're a legitimate threat to win the NBA Finals. That's why I have them second on my favorites list right now. But number one is Oklahoma City. This team's dominant. You know the deal with them. SGA very well might win MVP. They get a ton of great role players. One stat I want to focus on here, but actually before that stat, Aaron Wiggins, 20 points per game this past month, 41 versus the Kings, 26 against the Grizz, 24 versus the Pelicans. How is it that the Thunder keeps spawning all of these really good role players out of nowhere? And they're more than role players. They're actually like, oh, sometimes you look like a star, an all-star type of player. Wiggins is just a good example of what OKC's got going on there. But I want to talk about this stat. 31 minutes. We've seen Chet Holmgren sharing the floor with Isaiah Hartenstein. The Thunder have a 127.7 offensive rating in those minutes and a 93.5 defensive rating. That's a plus 34.1 net rating. Small sample size and only 31 minutes. And they only did it against Toronto and New Orleans. But you watch the film in those minutes. And this is what I'm talking about when I always harp about flexibility in lineups. They have this weapon that they can play with two bigs where you have Chet defending on the perimeter. There are plays where he's defending Scottie Barnes and corralling him on drives to the rim, and then Hartenstein flies over and alters the shot. There's plays where it's the opposite, where Chet comes over and also alters the shots at the rim. There's plays where Chet's defending a smaller guard or wing like Jacoby Walter, and Iso blocks the shot on the drive. Having these two bigs with skill on offense, with Chet's shooting ability, his creation, and then Hartenstein's screening, and just this the flow he plays with. He's got major skill, even if he's not shooting the ball. And then defensively, the versatility Chet brings, the interior protection and rebounding that Hartenstein brings. OKC's, they really did have the biggest deadline addition besides Luka to the Lakers. Chet Holmgren coming back changes the shape of this team and adds a whole new dimension. And in my eyes, makes them the favorite to win the NBA Finals ahead of Cleveland, ahead of Boston, ahead of Denver. But any of these four teams in this favorites group, I think are their strongest bets, obviously, to win the NBA Finals. And behind that, there's maybe three or four teams that have a shot. But one of these four feels like the very, very, very safe bet right now to win the NBA Finals. And I look forward to seeing the way things change over these last 25 to 30 games for all of these teams. We're entering the All-Star break now. Get a little breather. Maybe things change. Who knows? Got a lot to talk about. Make sure you subscribe to Yahoo Sports. Check out our website. Ton of great writing. Got my draft guide coming very, very soon. I'm looking forward to that, having that launch with all of my draft profiles as well. So stay tuned for all of that. Subscribe to the Kevin O'Connor Show. Give us a 5-star rating or a thumbs up on YouTube if you haven't done so already. We'll be back on the podcast version with Tom Haverstraw as we enter the All-Star break. So be sure to check that out as well. Now joining me is Tom Haverstraw. Tom, how you doing, man?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm doing excellent, man. So you know my power rankings for the championship power rankings. I have Denver at number 4. I think that's the biggest difference we have between my rankings that I just revealed on the podcast now and then your tiers that you do over on your Substack. You have them in your 3rd tier still, 3 stars. What do you think? Like, where are we different with Denver right now with how we view them as a contender?
Well, let me just preface this by saying the rankings that I do on TomTheFinder.com, that came out on Monday before I watched them back-to-back in these Blazers games. And covering those games, I got to see firsthand what kind of level Jokic and Jamal Murray are in right now. And this is like all-time two-man game that we've seen in the NBA, period. That's how good they've been. Like, 55 points from Jamal Murray on Wednesday night. And you have Jokic, who had 48-7 before the fourth quarter even started. He didn't even play in the fourth quarter. And, you know, both teams are dealing with injuries. It's right before the All-Star break. This is kind of like the last class before spring break for a lot of these guys. But you got to hand it to the offense. Mike Malone has done a great job of just making sure that when Christian Brown runs out on a fast break or leaks out, Jokic is going to find them every single time. They're on this like incredible scoring run. And I want to like put them in like top tier like you did, but I can't do it because the schedule just hasn't really been all that tough for them. You look at this streak that they're on when they've won 8 games in a row. Philly, Charlotte, Pelicans twice, Orlando, Phoenix, Portland. 8 games, 8 opponents below 500, and only one good defense out of there, and it's the Orlando Magic. And so they can only play what's in front of them, but I still have a little bit of concern about the defense. The offense I have no qualms about. I'm still probably going to put them on my second tier, not quite on the same tier as OKC, Boston, and Cleveland.
I think that's fair. It's totally fair. I just think like zooming out with Denver after their slow start, they were like 11-10, 12-10 early December. Since then, number 3 in net rating. So it's like not, they have beaten some tough opponents along the way. This streak, especially where Jamal Murray is really ascending, this is where it's like, okay, you take them more seriously instead of like, oh, they're winning these December and January games. Of course, like you said, it's against some weaker opponents, but I mentioned the stat in the power rankings earlier. I want you to hear it as well, Tom. Last season, the on-off differential for Jokic was 20.4. The season before that, when they won the championship, it was 22.9. Since that bad start, it's 15.8. They're a plus 14.1 with Jokic, no surprise. Only a minus 1.7 without him. Over this past month, they've been slightly over even without Jokic on the floor. And that's where I look at them with Murray getting way better as of late. The bench units, they've had Gordon come off the bench sometimes, Westbrook sometimes. Obviously, both of those guys are out right now, but it's Jalen Pickett this week against Portland. They have Zeke Nnaji starting games. Just feels like a team that is figuring out some good non-Jokic combinations. Murray and Porter and Brown out there together. It just feels like the team feels deeper because of some of these absences allowing young guys to play. Was that kind of your sense watching them this week? Because it's all about Murray going off for 55, but Jalen Pickett also had a big game off the bench too. Nnaji was great in the starting five in that second game against Portland.
He was. And, you know, Portland's been dealing with some injuries too. So DeAndre Ayton out, Jeremy Grant out, Scoot Henderson out. They've got Donovan Clingan being basically the only center for the team. And he played great. I mean, Donovan Clingan played awesome against Jokic. But a lot of the time, Tomani Kamara had to decide, am I going to guard Jokic or am I going to have to guard Jamal Murray? And it didn't matter who was guarding who. It was incredible, incredible basketball. And I think we need to, Kevin, put in perspective how good Jokic and Murray have been recently. So I went back into the numbers and looked at on-court offensive rating. With 2 stars on the floor in the month of February, guys who have played at least 100 minutes. I looked at some star duos here. You want me to run through this real quick?
Do it up.
Here we go. Let's start at the bottom here. Franz Wagner and Banchero, 100 offensive rating, meaning the team scores 100 points every 100 possessions with them on the floor.
That is very bad.
Yeah. We're starting at the bottom, like I said, 100 for them. Paul George, Tyrese Maxey, when they're on the floor, 103. Wemby and De'Aaron Fox, 110. Tatum, Jaylen Brown, 112. Haliburton and Siakam, 113. Okay, now we're starting to cook a little bit. Harden and Kawhi, 119. Okay, LeBron and Austin Reeves, when they're on the floor together, 122. Karl Anthony Towns, Jalen Brunson, 124. Okay, the NBA average is like somewhere around 110, okay? Cat and Jalen Brunson at 124. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Jalen Williams, J-Dub, 126 points every 100 possessions with those two guys on the floor. Unbelievable, 126. Jokic and Murray at 143.
Wow. Is that whole season?
That's just in the past month. Okay. 143.
Okay. I was about to say this past month. Okay.
This stretch that they've had together, they're at 143.
All of those are from the past month. All of those.
Yeah. So all those numbers that I gave you.
Wow.
So they're at 143 points every 100 possessions when they're on the floor together. And when that's not counting Aaron Gordon. When Aaron Gordon's on the floor, the big three for the Nuggets, it's still around 140 points every 100 possessions. That's absurd. All right, so like another way we could frame it is, 50-40-90 club. Kyrie Irving, when he's, cooking, he's 50-40-90. Steph Curry, 50-40-90. Kevin Durant, 50-40-90. 50% from the floor, 40% from three, 90% from the free throw line. During that stretch, the Denver Nuggets are 57-40-92 as a team. As a team. So it's just, this is the most efficient.
It seems impossible. It just doesn't seem like it's a thing for an entire team. It doesn't.
And that's Jokic, that's Murray, and Christian Brown, man. The synergy that he has with Jokic, where it feels like they're playing a video game, like they've got a cheat code that the pass is always going to be perfect. Brown's always going to catch it and finish at the rim, and he's always going to find an open lane. And Jokic just has this sixth, seventh sense of how to find his teammates in spots where you just don't understand how he got them the ball.
Tom, I think you're going to move him into your top tier eventually. I just don't think you're there yet. Well, like I am, but I think eventually you will. If they carry this into the second half, I understand, but they don't have Gordon right now. Gordon will be back eventually. I just feel like, dude, Golden State flopped with their two timeline plan. They flopped. Now we'll see what happens. Like, I think they need a bench buddy healed. Pods needs to be playing more. He looks better. Moody should be playing more. He looks better right now. Golden State, some of their young guys, Kuminga will be back. They could work out. But for Denver, Christian Brown already did work out. He helped them win a finals his rookie season. Zeke Nnaji, who looked horrible, he sure as hell looks a lot better, like everybody does, playing next to Jokic instead of behind Jokic. And maybe Denver stumbled into something there. Maybe they did. Maybe when Gordon comes back, bring him off the bench again and see how that works. Just throwing that thought out there, because Nnaji looks good in the starting five right now. And then you have guys like Peyton Watson with his defense.
Did you say Aaron Gordon? You said start Nnaji and bring Aaron Gordon off the bench?
Aaron Gordon coming off the bench for Russell Westbrook. Maybe have Russ come off the bench with Gordon, and you have this deep. I'm just saying, Denver feels deeper. They have so many more options. That's my only thought here. If it doesn't matter, like if there's diminishing returns having Gordon next to Jokic in the starting five, instead having him play with Russ for heavier minutes, bigger role off the bench, maybe that helps your bench units be a +4 without Jokic, or a +3 without Jokic, rather than being a -1, a -2. My overall point is, I feel like these young guys getting better, whether it's Nnaji, Pickett showing signs of life, guys like Brown continuing to get better, it feels like Malone has more options to shape this roster and these rotations in ways to make them even better. And that's something that's happened as a result of some of these injuries, young guys being forced to play, being forced to be creative. And that's what's increased my confidence in Denver, on top of Jamal Murray this past month looking like his normal self, as you'd expect. It's all of it combined, where Denver, if you're thinking about a team that can take down OKC, who we both have as our favorite, it's a team with Jokic, the best player in the world, where there's nothing your defense can do to stop him. That's what it's going to be. And Denver's got those pieces to potentially do that.
They're 18th in defensive rating. When they play a team that's over 500 or better, they have a losing record against those teams. If you look at their record against Boston, Cleveland, OKC, they're not doing well against the top of the top. And maybe this is a case where Jokic just rises to another level in the postseason, and Jamal Murray does it again, where he rises to another level. Certainly has done it. He was pissed off in Wednesday's game. He got ejected the game before, came out 55, and didn't matter what the Blazers did against him, he was going to get that bucket. When he's on a heater, there's maybe, three players in the NBA who can get hotter than Jamal Murray when he's at his hottest. It's like Clay and Steph. It's like there's no one really else on that list. Jamal Murray, it's just, if he can maintain that for more than just like 10 games or a 15-game stretch, because the beginning of the season, it was rough. You look at his effective field goal percentage month by month. Jamal Murray in October, 43%, 50% in November, 53% in December, 54% in January, and in February, he's at 61% effective field goal percentage, increasing every single time. You're right. The offense might be good enough to put them in that top tier, but still, their performance against the best teams in the NBA feels lacking to me. And defensively, I still have a lot of questions. Jokic, great offensive player. I just worry about that rim protection where they just don't have a lot right there. And for them to beat OKC, they're going to have to show a little bit more on the defensive end to put them in that top tier.
In that matchup against Portland this week, the second one, Klingon got his start, first game playing over 30 minutes since November. I mentioned in my power rankings earlier, hey, you know, if you're looking for a real sleeper for rookie of the year, Klingon could be playing heavy, heavy, heavy minutes to close the year. It sounds like Ayton could be out for the remainder of the season. Time Lord Robert Williams is out right now as well. Is that insane for me to even suggest that, Tom, with Klingon? Because I don't think so. He's plus 10,000 on multiple sports books right now. $5 wins you 500 on Klingon right now. That seems ridiculous to me.
That does sound ridiculous for two reasons. One, the playing time factor. He's going to get a lot of playing time, like you mentioned. And two, the field just isn't that strong this year. So someone is going to come out of that crowd and assert themselves in that race. And when you look at Donovan Klingon, he is, you know, a double-double every time he gets the minutes, right? He's been able to get these minutes recently with DA out. His best games have come against Jokic and Rudy Gobert. He had 8 blocks against the Minnesota Timberwolves earlier this year. He has 2 championships with UConn. This is a guy who rises to the challenge. And he got injured earlier with the knee issue. And now he's kind of getting back into shape. And he had really 2 tough assignments to guard Jokic and have to go against maybe the best big man of this generation in Jokic. And he held himself pretty well. You know, we're talking about a guy who's 20 years old still. And he has one of the best defense points in the paint, like opposing points in the paint. When that guy's on the floor, it's the same defensive points in the paint allowed as Victor Wembanyama. Klingon, per minute, he's up there with defensive player of the year candidates in terms of impact. He's got to cut down on the fouls. And if he can do that, man, he's going to have a great case for defensive player of the year. I mean, not defensive player of the year, but I'm saying rookie of the year. Not yet defensive player of the year.
Someday.
Rookie of the
someday.
Year.
Someday he might compete for it. Maybe in a year where Victor misses some time or voter fatigue kicks in, Klingon could definitely win it sometime.
He's 20 still, man. He's good. Yeah, he's really good. He's got a great quick jump. He has a high motor. He's got great hands. They're throwing lobs to him basically every play down the floor. And once he gets into better shape, I think that's one thing he's talked about is his conditioning and wanting to get in better shape and work on his body this coming summer, I think would do a great, great service to him going forward.
Blazers, only 4.5 back from the 10 seed right now. They're kind of playing their way out of top seeding or top lottery odds for Capture the Flag. You wrote an article on Yahoo this week, Capture the Flag. Which NBA teams have the best shot at landing the number one pick? And you go through the tanking teams and the teams who are playing really well lately. They might be playing themselves out of top odds like Portland. And then you mentioned some of these like teams that out of nowhere could do it. The possibility, if the Clippers free fall, OKC has their first round pick with the slim chances that OKC could win the lottery. The team I'm most intrigued by on your list, I made a post on X about this on Thursday. I think the Spurs are quiet tanking. That's my gut feeling with them continuing to start Chris Paul. I mentioned this stat on my power rankings earlier. We have seen these lineups for 28 minutes. Castle, Victor, Fox for 28 minutes. We've seen Victor, Fox, and Paul for 77 minutes. How is it that we're playing this old man over young Stephon Castle with Wemby and Fox, your future that you're so invested in, when Paul is worse today than Castle, less impactful, worse of a fit? It's because they're quiet tanking. That's why they're playing Castle less, Sohan less, these guys who are part of your future and can help you win more now. The Spurs are quiet tanking. That's my gut. They want to tank again and get another lottery pick to increase their chances at pooping for Cooper.
No, we can't call Chris Paul right now, who's averaging 8 assists a game, quiet tanking on efficient play.
Can't defend, can't score, doesn't get in the paint.
No, I am not gonna allow this Chris Paul slander on this show right now.
I respect Chris Paul, Tom.
No, you can't quiet tank. Acquiring De'Aaron Fox is not quiet tanking. And playing Chris Paul, who's a great organizer, he's still a good shooter. He's not gonna get downhill like he used to be, and he's not gonna make an impact defensively like he used to be. But Stephon Castle's good for his age. But that's not quiet tanking. I think quiet tanking would be letting Castle play 35 minutes through his mistakes.
No, they'd be better with Castle playing 35 minutes.
I mean, I'm not going to allow the slander but of the point guard, even though at this age, I'm not going to allow it. You can't tell me, I don't know. It's just the idea that this guy at his age, Chris Paul, should be playing at over 54. Stephon.
He's 54 years old.
No.
Look, I respect Chris Paul. I respect Chris Paul. I respect Wood to Curb reference. I respect Chris Paul. I mean, the guy's a Hall of Famer. He's had a great career, but he should come off the bench. He should come off the bench. And he didn't want to come off the bench last year in Golden State. Now San Antonio is finding out the same thing that Golden State did last year. He doesn't want to come off the bench. He doesn't feel comfortable coming off the bench, but he should come off the bench for the betterment of the team. If they don't want to make the playoffs, is my gut feeling. They want to miss the playoffs. They want to get another lottery pick and increase their odds with the Atlanta pick. Atlanta winning some games lately. San Antonio might have to take it into their own hands.
This is quite a take here. They're 10 points better with Chris Paul on the floor than when he's off the floor.
Doesn't matter. You get Fox now.
Okay. I was getting all excited about this piece that I wrote and saying how the San Antonio Spurs could get Cooper Flagg next to Victor Wembanyama. And then all of a sudden I'm walking into a Chris Paul hater session that, like, man, if he was turning the ball over every other time down the floor and he was like actively tanking on the court, I'd be like, maybe you're onto something. But that's not what's happening here. They're just slowly integrating De'Aaron Fox into the system. And once the training wheels are off, then maybe they bring in Castle with a lot more minutes next to Wemby and Vassell and Fox. But for now, like, you can't argue that they're quiet tanking with Chris Paul minutes. He's been good.
He's okay. He's fine. Come off the bench instead. Makes more sense. 77 minutes with that old man next to your future instead of the young man.
I went to college with this guy. I take offense to this that you're saying he's 54, bro. Come on. Like if he's 54, then I'm 54. Like, what happened here?
It's a different scale. It's like dog years. You're not old, Tom. Chris Paul's not old in human years, but in basketball years, he's got a walker. Okay? He just does.
Oh, no.
A quick reminder to listeners to please subscribe to the Kevin O'Connor Show. If you want more Chris Paul slander and you want Tom to get more uncomfortable with my Chris Paul slander, subscribe and give us a like on YouTube. Okay, Tom, the Lakers played the other night. They beat the Jazz first game. Second game, they lose to the Utah Jazz. A bit of a weird game. Dorian Finney-Smith was out. Gabe Vincent was out. Jackson Hayes gets a facial contusion after playing 8-9 minutes in the game. And we see extended Alex Len, who was absolutely horrible, just absolutely terrible. No surprise there. He's Alex Len. We've seen this for years now. I think with the Lakers, that loss against Utah did put into perspective how thin the margins are for them. Where if you're feeling the loss of Jackson Hayes, that does say something to me.
Yeah, Vando and LeBron might have to play the center like position for long stretches at the rest of the season. Like the center position is extremely thin. You got no Christian Wood. Jackson Hayes was out, and then you're bringing in Alex Len, who was just like signed like 3 minutes before the game, and then he has to go and play big minutes, and it was a disaster. And give him some grace. Like, he just came in and met all of his teammates and then has to go out there and play. But on the other hand, you're playing with two of the best table setters of all
time.
He's
over 32. We have a lot large sample of this, Tom.
Oh, God. Yeah, how old is Alex Len in dog years? Is there like a center? Is there a center multiplier effect here that if you're 30 years old at the center position, you played for the Kings, then you're actually 58? Is that what it is?
No. I've never had a dog, so I'm not too familiar with the dog years parallel. I'd love to have a dog. I love dogs. I'm a Chris Paul skeptic, but I'm not a dog skeptic. I love dogs, but I've never had one. So maybe what, is 17 really old for a dog?
Yeah, you don't know like how old dogs are, like when they pass.
12, they vary. Yeah. Different breeds are different ages, sure. Right? That's sure. Correct, right?
I've got a 5-year-old dog right now. I feel like she's in her prime. I think the math is like times 7, so 35. Although there's this alternate theory that it's actually a curve. Like you can't just do the math of times 7. It's like the first year is actually 5, I don't know. There's a whole dog math to this that I don't want to get bogged down into. What I do want to point out is Luka Doncic and LeBron James, when they play on the floor together, it should be better than what we saw on Wednesday night against the Utah Jazz. It should be better on paper. I'm interested to see, you know, they have a couple minutes. JJ Redick has had a couple minutes without Luka or LeBron on the floor. I thought he was going to stagger those minutes and just have Luka and LeBron on the floor for all 48 minutes, or basically, the whole game, when the game is in within reach, you're going to have those guys on the floor. Maybe he's working Luka back in, just doesn't want to overexert him when he's coming back from the calf issue. But I've noticed that when Luka is on the floor, Austin Reeves doesn't turn into like a third fiddle, he turns into a fifth fiddle. Like it should be better than this. But when you look at Austin Reeves and the way he was playing before Luka came, I kind of want to make sure that those three guys are considered like a big three rather than just a big two. And that's one of my concerns, is losing Austin Reeves a little bit in this Luka integration.
I'm not reading into it too much necessarily. Just Luka's second game back, tons of guys out. You're right. To be fair to Alex Len, he just signed. He's rolled out there for extended minutes after not playing much at all this season. So it's, you know, it's a tough situation that night. No DFS. A lot of important guys and pieces were out for them. It's just, you know, we did praise, you and I, the small ball aspect with that LeBron, Luka, DFS lineup with what that potentially can be. They still need to have the flexibility to play a big out there. The Jazz did win that game, though. Isaiah Collier, really good again. Been very impressive to see him continuing to ascend over the course of the season, averaging over 10 assists over his last 6 games. Keontae George had a nice game as well. Still needs to get more consistent shooting. But one of the interesting things on the Jazz broadcast, you sent me a text with a link to this. I didn't see it live. Zanuck, their general manager, was interviewed about the trade, how the Jazz were the third team in the trade, and they asked him his thoughts, and he's like, well, Pelinka mentioned this during his press conference. It was a gift. It was like shocking to hear a GM speak so openly about that. And he's like, if we were a contending team and not just a team accepting free stuff in the trade, maybe we would have asked more questions about what we're getting involved into. It was just so transparent. It was really interesting. I believed, you know, every word that was said.
Yeah, Justin Zanuck saying, you know, Rob Pelinka said it was a gift. And that's not to speak for my colleagues around the league, but I think we would characterize it as a gift as well. Dude, he was involved in the trade. Like the idea of like, yeah, that was a highway robbery right there. And yet the Jazz were helping to facilitate that trade. He did say, like, look, if we didn't facilitate that trade, and another team would have done it. So it's not like we were the make or break missing piece to get that trade done. But it was great to hear the competition from a GM of an NBA team going on the record to say, we all here in the NBA thought it was nuts that Nico Harrison would trade Luka Doncic. And he said it. He was like, a generational global superstar. And getting Anthony Davis, who, yes, is a top 15 pick, a top 15 player in the league, but it was a gift. And that was wild to hear, but it was refreshing to hear because, you know, I think there is a competitive nature among players, but also GMs are kind of loath to talk about other GMs' deals because I think there is kind of this competition, this edge to it that Rob Pelinka just got this superstar handed to him, and he said it was a gift. So that was a really, I thought it was cool. And at the Blazers broadcast, we had an interview with Joe Cronin, not about that trade, obviously, but I want more of these GM interviews to get more insight into how they feel about particular moves around the league, just so that we have some of these fresh quotes where they're like, yeah, Rob Pelinka got a gift in Luka Doncic, man. And that guy, he facilitated the trade.
it's tough because like a lot of these GMs want to avoid tampering charges, because if you speak, you know, in a certain way about another player on another team, it's like, oh, you get a fine, you get a fine. And so it's tough for them to talk about it. Or as a coach can say before a game how amazing a player is and how much, you know, they respect them and all that. It's so much easier for the coaches to get into that than the GMs are. But yes, I'd love to see more of that transparency too, because it's, you know, interesting to hear them speak so openly about it. What do you make about this recent bowl surge, Tom, for the Phoenix Suns? They're not winning these games with bowl starting, but bowl looks good. Shaq might be right?
No, he's not right. Dude, my favorite tweet of the night was from StatMuse. They did this comparison of bowl and Wemby as starters, and it was hilarious. Not just because of it was such a troll, because you had the stats from bowl as a starter and Victor Wembanyama side by side, and you're like, oh, actually they're pretty comparable. What they didn't tell you is that it's one game for bowl. It's one game for bowl. And I'm like laughing, I'm giggling, like, because the numbers are like 18.0 points, 12.0 rebounds, da 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 da. And I'm like, it's just one game. And I went through the comments, the replies, and no one got it. They were all like, wow, so actually, funny. It looks like it's a pretty, you know, reasonable comparison. I'm like, oh, my God. Like, we can't be doing the bowl is better than Wemby take anymore. He's talented, but he's like a one-on-one all-star. Like, if I could pick draft a team of guys to play one-on-one, and just he's focused on getting buckets and all he has to do is guard the guy in front of him. Like, he's a really good NBA player, but in a five-on-five context, it's going to be a struggle for any team that wants to be competitive to have bowl out there. He reminds me of Hassan Whiteside, where his numbers look good and coaches just refuse to play them. And then you realize, like, the next time he makes a play for another guy, will be the first time. Like, that's my thing with bowl is he's a great one-on-one guy, just not a team player.
Well, I mean, I picked him up in fantasy. He was 2% owned at the time I picked him up. He's now 32% owned. Pretty fast rise over on Yahoo Sports fantasy basketball. Maybe he'll be a keeper. Maybe I'll drop him at some point soon. All I know is I'm very disappointed I missed out on Donovan Clingan. I wanted him. I woke up and he was gone. Freaking competition in there.
When does waivers refill? What is it? You have to put in your waivers at like by 3 a.m. or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. Waivers by 3 a.m. But you know, he was a free agent.
The Warriors game.
But who do you think got him? Who do you think? Dan Titus, the fantasy expert. Of course, Dan Titus got him. He beat me to him. And now I'm trying to trade for him. Last thing here, Tom. Paul George, 1 of 7 on Wednesday night for the Philadelphia 76ers in a game in which both Kelly Oubre and Quentin Grimes dropped 30. Is Paul George over? Are the Sixers like dead? Or do you have any bit of hope left for them? They're the team. I still have them in the middle of the pack in my power rankings. Do you have any hope for Philly and Paul George specifically?
Paul George is verging on Chris Middleton with $150 million coming to him.
Oh, my God. Oh,
like,
my God.
Like, it's bad. Like he looks like he had both ankles worked on in the offseason. Like, just... it's uninspiring. The numbers, he's got 9 20-point games this season. 9. Kelly Oubre has more. Kelly Oubre looks like the better player right now than Paul George. And Paul George has $56 million coming to him in 3 years. In 28, he's got $56 million player option, which at this point, 100.0% that he is going to pick up that player option. And by the way, Joel Embiid, also $60 million coming with him that season. So in 2028, the 76ers are paying Joel Embiid and Paul George $110 million. And this is how they're playing right now.
God, that's hard to believe, man. Scary. I don't think you can trade Embiid right now, even if you wanted to. If he demanded a trade, I'm not sure if you'd be able to deal him right now. He needs over the second half of this season to show he can play consistently and continue playing at a high level consistently, because he's been good when he's been out there. I don't think the Sixers can pull the plug on the year. I think with the fact their pick is only top six protected, they have to try to go for it and make the most of this season. But it's not looking good, Tom. To me, that's one of the biggest questions post All-Star break, is what does Philly look like? When we enter the new year, my biggest question is, how's Jamal Murray going to get better? is one of my biggest questions. One of them now is, how does Paul George look after this little rest he gets? How does Embiid look? And does Philly make themselves look like, hey, we can be a 7 seed or an 8 seed and maybe make some noise? But right now, it's looking very, very bleak for them. Tom, thank you, man. I look forward to talking with you in about a week after All-Star break, man. I hope you enjoy the time off, man.
Hey, appreciate it. It's been great. Enjoy the All-Star weekend in the Bay. And I gotta give a shout out to the big number we did, the All-Star MVP. I came in thinking with Dan Devine that it was going to be Steph because he's in his home city. This is his All-Star game that he invented. But man, wouldn't it be great, KOC, if Wemby took his crown and just said night-night?
That would be amazing if he did that. I mean, Steph not participating in the three-point event, the NBA really dropped the ball there. I don't think Stern would have let this happen. In the Bay? You kidding me?
Man. And Adam Silver just had the press conference in Paris saying, we run leagues. That's what we do. And they could not get like a WNBA-NBA shootout between Winescu and Caitlin Clark, Clay and Steph in the Bay. Man,
that's absurd.
And then he's not in the three-point contest. Man, big
whiff.
This is tough.
Big, big whiff. Tom, thank you, man.
You got it.
Thanks to Tom Haverschow for joining me on today's episode of the Kevin O'Connor Show. Please subscribe if you have not done so already. Give us a 5-star rating and a thumbs up on YouTube. Thanks to Stone and Mike for producing. Hope you have a great rest of your weekend. Enjoy the All-Star game. We get a lot planned for next week and the weeks to come, so stay tuned.